This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. With a budget this year of nearly $28 billion, the National Institutes of Health funds research into illnesses ranging from AIDS to breast cancer to depression. Conducting research on diseases often means collaborating with drug companies that will take discoveries from the lab to the pharmacy. But recently, Congress has begun to question the propriety of some of those collaborations. For example, a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health was apparently paid over $500,000 in honoraria and consulting fee over the course of several years by the drug company Pfizer. And many in Congress seem to think that's a bit extreme for a federal employee. Congress has held hearings to look into how these financial arrangements are monitored and whether there is a conflict of interest in allowing NIH scientists to receive payments from the same groups who receive NIH grants. What should be the relationship between government-paid scientists and industry? Are there good reasons for allowing researchers to do outside consulting work? How should those recent partnerships be governed? That's what we'll be talking about on this hour. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guests. Ilias Zerhouni is the director of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Zerhouni.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine. Good to talk to you. Also, Republican Congressman Jim Greenwood is the representative for the 8th District of Pennsylvania. He's the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. He joins us by phone. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us, Mr. Greenwood.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure.
So I'd like to start with you, Congressman. Where did this topic get onto the radar screen of your committee? Why are you interested in this issue?
Well, we began by looking at very general questions that had to do with compensation of federal employees at the NIH. When this administration, the Bush administration, came in and the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, former Governor Thompson, took over, routine examination of financial reports from the NIH indicated some very high levels of salary that exceeded what you would see in the civil service code. So we began to look at that as well and to learn how those scientists at NIH are being compensated. What we found was that under Dr. Zerhouni's predecessor, Dr. Varmus, a number of steps were taken to try to make NIH more competitive with the private sector. They instituted what's called Title 42 payments, where scientists could be paid more than civil servants normally would be paid. They allowed them to accept sometimes rather significant-sized speaking awards as part of during the course of their work. They also allowed them to receive retention bonuses. If someone in the private sector offered them a job paying more, they could get up to a $50,000 a year retention bonus, and then ultimately earn money on the outside working for pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies. So we looked at all of that, and we began to ask questions. Is this kosher? Does this create conflicts of interest? Is this consistent with the mission of the NIH? Is this what taxpayers are paying for?
Right. And do you see some basic reason why federal employees should not ever accept money from industry or universities, or is this a case by case kind of thing?
Well, I don't think it's to some extent it's a case by case, but I think I think we need to have some clear rules that an ethicist would say make sense. We need to make sure, for instance, that no one who is in the business of giving out grants to universities and health centers would be eligible to receive a cash award from one of those grantees, which would obviously certainly create the appearance, if not the fact, of a conflict of interest, an incentive to give a large award out to someone who's given you an award. We want to make sure that there aren't conflicts of interest so that if a scientist at the NIH is doing a clinical study for on a product that's been developed by one pharmaceutical company and at the same time is working, moonlighting, if you will, for a competitive pharmaceutical company, we wouldn't want there to be any appearance or reality of conflict there as well. And we also have a concern about conflict of conviction, if you will. That is, if you're being paid twice as much in an ounce outside, from an outside private source, as you're being paid by the taxpayers, where's your real commitment? Is your commitment to the pharmaceutical company, is your commitment to the federal government?
Okay. Dr. Zuhuni, has Mr. Greenwood uncovered things that make you uncomfortable and will lead to changes, or is he misunderstanding relationships that have existed that are perfectly kosher, to use his word?
No, I think I would echo everything the Congressman Greenwood said. It is appropriate for us to review these interactions, and I think what his committee has done is outstanding, and we've been working together because at the end of the day, we need to serve the American public, and with no either real or perceived conflict of interest. We, especially in the matter that relates to medical research, where the health of individuals is concerned, I think we should be extremely sensitive to those issues. And I think the congressman is doing a great job. I have to say, if I was as a taxpayer, I'm extremely pleased to see his committee looking with a really a great sense of policy development into these issues. And we've reached a conclusion, like the committee and Chairman Greenwood, that it would be great for us to have much clearer rules and better ways of drawing the line, if you will, between what needs to be done to improve our prospects of developing treatments and cures and what should be off-limit in terms of public duty relative to private interests. That's why I've proposed changes that relate to the dual nature of NIH. One of the things that people don't understand from the outside is NIH is both a granting agency that has the stewardship of public funds under its mission, but it's also a very advanced research laboratory that looks at public health issues such as the safety of the blood supply, developing vaccines, and so on. And what we've proposed, and I think the congressman is supportive, pending obviously the details that we're developing right now, we propose to make sure that there's a firewall between those individual scientists who have responsibility for grant making or responsibilities for government functions from consulting with industry or universities that could in fact benefit from the relationship. But at the same time, with proper oversight and proper rules, continue to allow interactions that truly are in a bona fide way designed to enhance our scientific progress. At the end of the day, this is what we want to accomplish.
So under what sort of circumstances do you think, whether these new rules will spell them out or whether you can just tell us generally, under what circumstances can a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, who's a federal employee, gets a check from the Department of Health and Human Services every week or 2 weeks or whatever, right, under what circumstances is it appropriate for that person to be collecting consulting fees from a pharmaceutical company, let's just say.
Right. First of all, if that person has any responsibility in terms of grant making or policy decision making within the institute, that shouldn't be allowed. That's number one.
And is that allowed now, or is that not allowed?
Under
and you're just going to codify
under,
it
under the rules that were promulgated in 1995. This was not expressly prohibited.
Okay. So this is going to be expressly prohibited? For
Yes, I think this is the appropriate thing to do because you can never separate truly the individual from their decisions within their institutes, and you can always end up with the appearance that the decisions they made was not completely independent. We want to avoid that at all costs.
Okay.
So if that individual had that responsibility, they couldn't do it. Let's now assume the case of someone who did not have any of these federal responsibilities, basically a pure laboratory researcher in a laboratory and doing something that may be of value to an outside entity. Two things can happen. If what they're asked to do relates to their government job within their laboratory, we will not allow that to happen because that's their official duty. So you cannot have an outside activity with a pharmaceutical company if it relates directly to what you're paid for for the government. However, because of the changes in government ethics rules 1993, the courts have found and the government has found that you can't totally restrict the ability of an individual to express their ability to contribute and receive compensation for other things, such as writing a book or doing things that is not related to their day job, if you will.
Okay.
But
well,
in that context, what we need to do, though, is to review every case, as the congressman said. Congressman Greenwood is right. It's a case-by-case analysis where we need to make sure, A, there's no overlap with their government function. Two, there is a limit on the amount of compensation and the amount of time. We do not want to have stock or stock options used as compensation, and that, in fact, there is proper oversight of that interaction.
Well, Mr. Greenwood, let me ask you. I mean, I take it that you're not objecting to some scientist who wants to write a book about, you know, sail fishing or something like that, sailboat, you know, control or something. You have different issues in mind.
Well, that's right. Right, that's right. And not only do I not object if someone wants to earn money outside of their regular, as long as they're putting in the time that is expected of them from the government and doing their job, if they have general expertise, if someone is doing a very narrow research function at NIH, but generally speaking, they know a lot about microbiology, and on Saturdays they want to teach at a community college, of course that's not a problem. And it's not even a problem if they take what they know about microbiology and, given limited number of hours and limited number of dollars, actually get paid by a pharmaceutical company to help them develop a product that's going to save lives or reduce suffering in the world. It is to everyone's advantage that there be a cross-fertilization of intellect here between the private and the public sector. What we just have to make absolutely certain of is that the work that's done on the outside does not in any way undermine or conflict with the job that the taxpayers are paying you to do, and that your primary focus is to do that function. And if the company is asking you for information that you're getting paid to learn, if that's your area of expertise, well, you want to be able to give that information out for free. You shouldn't get paid a second time for learning what you're learning while you're working at the NIH.
Gentlemen, I know you both have to leave in a minute or so I just want to ask you both quickly, is the problem that the rules aren't clear, or is the problem that the rules are clear enough but that people haven't been following them? Maybe I could start with you, Mr. Greenwood.
Well, it's been some of each. I think the rules have not been clear. I think prior to Dr. Zerhouni's tenure, there was a rather loose culture on which I think certain folks, certainly not most, but some folks at the NIH felt that they were elite scientists and the normal rules didn't apply to them. And then there were some who just, for whatever reasons, tragically decided to break the rules as loose as they were. And let me say that I am a huge fan of Dr. Zerhouni. He has been a great partner in all of this. His interest is at least as fervent as his mind that NIH be free of any ethical taint, and I'm confident that together we're going to accomplish that.
Dr. Zerhouni?
Yeah, I think that we're on the same page on this one. What really was clear to me is that the rules were not completely transparent. There wasn't complete disclosure. There wasn't really a process of oversight, and more importantly, a peer review process, an independent review process. And this is what we're putting in place. And I think at the end we'll end up with a model for the federal government, but a model in general how to do it right.
Okay, well, it sounds like we're all on the same page on that one. I thank you both for talking. We're going to continue this discussion with some members of a Blue Ribbon panel that Dr. Zerhouni has convened just to talk about some of the issues. But first, I'd like to thank both my guests for this segment. Ilya Zerhouni is the director of the National Institutes of Health, and Jim Greenwood is the congressional representative for the 8th District of Pennsylvania.
Thank you for your interest.
Thanks very much. We'll be back to talk some more about conflict of interest after this short break. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about conflict of interest at the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. Now joining me are two members of a Blue Ribbon panel that the director of the National Institutes of Health, Ilya Zerhouni, asked brought into being to look into the conflict of interest policies that currently exist. First, I'd like to introduce Thomas H. Murray. He's a bioethicist and president of the Hastings Center in Garrison, New York. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Murray.
Thank you very much, Joe.
And James Sido is Vice Provost for Research and a Professor of Biology at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. He also joins us by phone. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Sido.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joe.
And, of course, I'd like to invite our listeners to join us. The number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And, Dr. Sido, maybe I could start with you. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about what conclusions the Blue Ribbon panel came to after you deliberated? And now, as I understand it, Dr. Zerhouni has even thought that maybe they need to be tightened up a little bit.
Well, I think that's correct. And actually, I think a lot of our general conclusions were roughly the same as Dr. Zerhouni spelled out in his summation statement a few minutes ago, and that is that the rules that got promulgated in, 1995 were simply... To begin with, they probably were too loose in terms of putting any sort of any kinds of restrictions on, but more importantly, they weren't very clear. And so issues that related to reporting, which weren't very well defined and weren't very stringent, oversight was not very well defined and not very stringent, those things really led, I think, to the opening up of a certain looseness of culture that was referred to earlier. And our committee, in looking at, aside from thinking that there needed to be some real rules in place about what could be earned and who could earn it, also felt that there really needed to be a tightening up of the application, so that there was a better sense of what was actually going on with respect to potential conflicts of interest, if you will, outside activities, most of which aren't conflicts of interest, and the like.
Right. I want to get at this question. I mean, there are obviously certain kinds of activities that are just never going to cause a problem. But if you're developing a drug for Alzheimer's, let's just say, the interest of a pharmaceutical company in your work is going to be for your expertise on Alzheimer's. So aren't you always going to be in a potentially conflicted situation if you start working with a company that's interested in your special expertise?
Well, this is basically if... In point of fact, you can't work with that company as a consultant. Remember, any outside consulting is not done on your NIH time, I think, as Dr. Zerhouni said. You're in essence doing that on vacation or possibly on weekends. So consequently, if you're working on your time, there are mechanisms in place. They're called CRADAs, for developing formal relationships with industry to do joint collaborative research between the NIH researcher and the industry, and that's perfectly within the bounds. And so there's a perfectly legitimate mechanism for doing that, and it's the way you say it. If you're doing it outside of your normal NIH functions, then obviously the potential for conflict of interest becomes very real.
I got it. Dr. Murray, is openness the most important thing here, or are we talking about a bigger issue that we need to get at?
We're talking about a number of values in science that we really need to protect, and this would be true in academic science, not just that, government science at NIH. We need to protect the freedom of inquiry, the freedom to ask the questions that are most responsive to human needs and most driven by science. We need to protect very clearly and unequivocally the freedom to publish the results of your work. We need to protect the education of the next generation of scientists, and we need to be sure that the public and policymakers get full free and unimpeded access to the best scientific opinion about whatever issues are before us. And so the rules about conflicts of interest and conflict of commitment, the two tend to get conflated, are both important in assuring those goals.
But it is possible, you think, for people to manage some kind of a balance where they are still committed to their primary responsibility and yet have interests that might sometimes be at odds, or can you do you have to completely divorce yourself from anything that might be a conflict situation?
Well, at the Hastings Center, we're just completing a larger research project on the ethics of conflicts of interest in biomedical research, and I think the world's messy, and policymakers, the same, you know, Congressman Greenwood and others, members of the House and Senate, reached a decision close to 25 years ago to encourage much more interaction between scientists who are not working in industry and the industry itself. So this is a matter of public policy that was made, and a lot of effort of the past 24 years has been to figure out what the right balance is. So number one, conflicts of interest are ubiquitous in life, so the fact that one exists doesn't necessarily mean that everything's gone to pot.
Right.
But we do have to very carefully remember what it is we're trying to protect, and we have to manage them, or in some cases simply outright prohibit certain kinds of relationships that would threaten those values. And that's what we try to do in the panel, and that's what Dr. Zerhouni has been working on, I think.
Okay, well, a lot of people are seem to be interested in this topic, so let's go to some of our callers. First, let's go to John in Yuba City, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Joe. Thank you very much for talking about this very important interface between science and industry. I am a part of a growing group of a small number of doctors who are really outraged at the way that, in our practice, drug companies have intruded to the point where they're occupying so much time by the physician that they actually bring detriment to patient care, which I think is the bottom line. Also, I'm just appalled at the impact on continuing medical education. Doctors are insulated now from anything having to do with continuing education that doesn't directly pertain to developing of a new alternative drug. And the drugs are just simply not that great as far as replacements in my area. I'm a psychiatrist, and we see good drugs going by the board while drugs that have increasing numbers of problems are pushed and then taken off the market. It's a disaster for patient care and for medicine.
Interesting
Thank
question.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Oh, great. Thanks for calling, John. So, Dr. Seto, maybe you can address that point. Is this an issue that that the research scientist also has to be sensitive to?
Oh, it's an issue that the research. First of all, I think this may be a topic for another show,
yeah,
but nevertheless, for a complete show. But nevertheless, it certainly is an issue that research scientists have to worry about. In the development of alternative drugs, I think it is oftentimes the case that the drugs have been developed that may be no more efficacious than the ones that are on the market that are much cheaper. And, of course, the thing you worry about then is when drug trials are carried out, that there be absolutely no conflict of interest associated with the scientists, the researchers that are carrying those trials out. So they're, as going back to Dr. Murray's point, they're completely free and not bound by any restrictions or associations with the company to simply state what the results of that research are, freely and openly.
Okay. Let's go to John in Dayton, Ohio. John, welcome to the program.
Yes, earlier you mentioned one of the pharmaceutical companies by name. I just wonder if there are any other companies that you can identify that may be participating in this.
I'm not sure. If I have numbers, I'd be stunned if there wasn't a single one that wasn't in some way involved in payments to scientists. But maybe Tom Murray, did you get a sense that this is widespread? Or Dr. Seto?
Only to the extent that several drug companies' names have appeared in the popular press. I mean, that's basically where I've gotten my information.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I have to explain. We've lost our connection to Dr. Murray. That's why I had to suddenly jump in and ask you, Dr.
No problem.
Dr. Seto. Let's take a call from Ken in Placerville, California. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. What a great program. You know, one of the things... And it's real nice having scientists to talk to. Rather than this just being a situation where we look at an isolated experience or even how it's happening just in research, it's also a real systemic situation that we have going on. Whenever you put greed up as one of the big icons in our society to everybody that needs to move towards, I'm a little nervous, so hang there.
Oh, sorry. Take a deep breath and go with it.
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting, you know, I'm 55 and I have 4-year-old twins and a 10-year-old. And so I have these nice little primates running around myself, and they're greedy. You know, it's just their nature. And part of what we have to do is to begin to mature them in a way so that they understand the benefits in society as a whole about how to share and how to find other markers that give them feedback about who they are besides their possessions and besides how much money. And I think, you know, if you look at our society, not just America, I'm not down on America, but if you just look at a society this rich, it's very difficult if money is the main bag that people get for what they are and the work they do.
Got it.
Do you get what I'm saying?
I think so. I think so.
You know, because it's a systemic thing. I mean, I don't want you to leave dealing with a specific problem, but let us not march away from looking at, you know, we need to have a bigger conversation as well.
I got it. Ken, thanks for the call. Dr. Murray, do we need people watching us in order to behave in an ethical manner, or do you think people can internalize those ethical rules?
Well, we have to begin by learning them at the stage at which this man, Ken, was talking about his children when we're very young. And we do have to internalize them. But all of us are susceptible to self-deception and self-delusion. So we do occasionally need reminders, and we need sometimes external authorities to set us back on the straight and narrow. I mean, I think NIH did, as Dr. Zerhouni stated, get somewhat lax between about 95 and 2003 on both what its rules were and on the enforcement of the rules. And I think things are tightening up now, and the changes recommended track fairly closely the changes that the Blue Ribbon Panel proposed, although Dr. Zerhouni has tightened up even further on the amount of income that could be earned externally.
Got it. Dr. Sido, can I just ask you a different point that I don't want to end this segment without getting to, and that is this. This Title 42 that Congressman Greenwood mentioned that allows NIH scientists to be brought in at higher salaries because, you know, for competitive reasons, those scientists can go to industry and get higher salaries. So for the government to get the best people, they pay the top dollar. Is there any limit? Because I've talked to scientists who say if the NIH scientist doesn't have the flexibility of an academic scientist to form consulting relationships, NIH just isn't going to get the best talent. Is that really what's going on here? Is there no compensation as like being a good public citizen and working in a public institution and giving up some of the options to make the big bucks?
Well, that's a really good question, Joe. And I mean, it simply is partly the case that as salaries, I think one of the problems was, and it's important to recognize, people have for a long time called NIH the jewel in the crown of the American health system, and it really has been. And if you look at who's in charge of medical centers today, every one of them used to go through NIH. I think one of the problems was the discrepancy, or the delta, if you will, between what you could earn at NIH and what you earned in the outside world in those days was a lot smaller. And it was a lot less. And so the concept you're talking about, of serving the nation, serving the health community, if you will, in a broader public context, was not seen as coming at such a large cost financially. I think now with the salary differential that's taken place between what people can earn at the NIH, particularly in the high end, some of the high-end areas at NIH, and what they can earn outside is so large that there is a concern that if they aren't able to basically supplement that income in some way, that the NIH could suffer a brain drain, if you will. Whether or not that'll happen, I think Harold Varmus, when he instituted the rules in 1995, instituted them with the notion that there was a problem at NIH, and that if he was going to attract the kind of scientists that had been there back in the 60s, or a larger number of those scientists, he was going to have to basically put in place a system that would allow some more flexible supplementation of income.
Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another call. How about Tom in Boston, Massachusetts? Welcome to the program, Tom.
Oh, hi there. I'm a research scientist at one of the academic hospitals in Boston, and I had a question regarding journal publications, and specifically some of the major journals recently in newspapers have spoken out on full disclosure of potential conflicts of interest for authors. And as a research scientist, one of my concerns is, can we reasonably expect that authors in prestigious journals who have financial relationships with companies can publish regarding their products and really take these articles seriously, because these are sometimes authors who are receiving tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in consulting fees and honoraria. And I was wondering if the guests had some comments on this.
Well, Dr. Murray, Tom Murray, maybe you have a thought about that? I'd be interested.
Yeah, a thought or two. One reason to have these disclosure rules about conflicts of interest by people who publish, also by people who review articles, because as any scientist knows, if you want to publish in a good journal, it's going to be reviewed by a number of your peers. All of those people ought to be disclosing their any potential financial conflicts of interest to the editors of the journal, and the editors should then, in my view, also disclose that information, at least about the authors, to the readers, and allow the readers to make a judgment about whether or not that that conflict of interest in some way undermines anything about the article itself. The other thing that's a movement that I think is a very welcome one, and it's one that I wholeheartedly support, and that is to create a national or international registry of advanced-stage clinical trials, so that when drugs, for example, are being tried out, whether it be in the United States or elsewhere, when a new drug is being tried out, that we know that that's going on. Because in the past, what's happened is unsuccessful clinical trials have been buried without any publication, and that information does not always reach the public and policymakers.
Dr. Sito, quickly, you can have one last word on this topic, if you wish.
I totally agree with Tom. I think full transparency is really the best remedy for avoiding the kinds of concerns or problems that the questioner raised. And I think that the kind of transparency that he cited is exactly what we need with clinical trials.
But you would agree that just because a pharmaceutical company is involved in research doesn't make it irrelevant or wrong. It just means you have to know about it.
Oh, no, absolutely. And again, the peer review system should do a good job of establishing whether or not these results pass the scientific litmus test.
Okay, gentlemen, both, thank you very much. I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'd like to thank Thomas H. Murray. He's a bioethicist and president of the Hastings Center in Garrison, New York. And James Sito is vice provost for research and a professor of biology at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Thanks to both of you for talking with us today. When we come back from a short break, we'll be talking about thinking. Think about it. We'll be right back.